diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am your host, Brandon, and I'm joined by Hale. On this episode, we're going to be reading two more articles from the New York Times philosophy column, The Stone. Both of these articles are by Simon Critchley, and they are circa 2014-2015. The first one is The Dangers of Certainty, A Lesson from Auschwitz. And the second is There is No Theory of Everything. Now, I'm introducing them kind of parallel to each other because they have something similar going on. And even from the titles, I think you can kind of gather the theme that we're going to be talking about today, which is certainty, the position that certainty puts you in, the consequences of being certain, the kind of people who become certain in particular things. We might talk a little bit about ideology and its relation to certainty. By way of introduction, it might be useful if we just start talking a little bit about the articles. Just get them down in summary, and then we can talk about them. So the first article here, The Dangers of Certainty, A Lesson from Auschwitz. It's a bit self-titled, but specifically, Simon Critchley is talking about his experience with a TV series. I think this was in the early, this was the 70s and early 70s. There was a TV series called The Ascent of Man, hosted by one Dr. Bernowski. And in it, Bernowski goes through and explores all kinds of facets of science and history and whatnot, and it left a particular impression on Critchley. But one episode in particular that Dr. Bernowski goes through, or that one episode that he hosts, is about, it's a historical episode on Auschwitz and the consequences of World War II and whatnot. But specifically, Bernowski wants to highlight the role that certainty played in the war, obviously, but specifically in the ideologies and the ideas that led to the consequences of this war.
Critchley, in his own article, actually has an excerpt from Bernowski's sort of speech that he gives, talks he gives at the end of the episode for Auschwitz. And it should be worth noting that Bernowski was Jewish. He's passed away, his past sense. But also that he was a Polish Jew, and a very effectively his entire community, including most of his family members, died at Auschwitz or similar camps, you know, during the genocide, the Holocaust. So it was deeply, like, personal for him to go, and I think it was the second last episode of the series. But this is what Bernowski says when he's at Auschwitz in the series. He said, "It's said that science will dehumanize people and turn them into numbers. That is false. Tragically false. Look for yourself. This is the concentration camp and crematoria at Auschwitz. This is where people were turned into numbers. Into this pond were flushed the ashes of some 4 million people. And that was not done by gas. It was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. When people believe that they have absolute knowledge with no test in reality, this is how they behave. This is what men do when they aspire to the knowledge of gods." So I thought that was a pretty, like, succinct and powerful moment from Bernowski, obviously talking with deep personal experience at Auschwitz-Birkenau. And I think in some ways that little speech highlights a lot of what we're going to be talking about today and a lot of what comes up in both of Critchley's articles, which is this notion of certainty and also certainty in relationship to scientific facts and scientific truths and personal humanistic truths. Those are two of the big themes that run through both of the articles.
Yeah, definitely. And especially, I think that's a pretty succinct kind of summary of the themes of this. If we're going to kind of bring out the themes of both of them more explicitly, we should get the other one on the table. But we can get to there by highlighting that notion of a kind of scientific certainty passing over or obliterating a more humane certainty. There's a pretty, I mean, I haven't seen the episode, but Critchley describes a moment where Bernowski is moving through the camps and just kind of pondering and seeing people at these camps, that there were human lives here, and he's trying to attend to the human lives that were here, that a certain kind of, like a certain scientific and numerical way of thinking didn't allow the Nazis to see, and it enabled this to happen. But the other article, There Is No Theory of Everything, responds to the response to this observation in the first article that there really is, well, it's in the title, There Is No Theory of Everything. In the first article, we were reading about Dr. Bernowski, and in this second article, we are reading about Frank Chioffi, who was Simon Critchley's philosophy professor. And
yeah, Critchley, from reading these two articles, you get the sense that he really likes to pull from like mentors effectively. And even though like Dr. Bernowski wasn't like actually someone he knew personally, at least that's not disclosed in the article, Critchley is clearly someone who is reflecting back upon, you know, impactful intellectual people in his young life. Obviously, Bernowski and Kofi, Professor Kofi, are the two that he's talking about these two articles.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I noticed between these two articles. And I think we'll explore this more as we unpack kind of what Critchley wants to suggest in the face of things like theories of everything or dogmatic ideologies and whatnot. But we can already kind of see, just in his form of writing and the genres he's choosing to work in, a sort of biographical form, that there is something about attending to people that Critchley is kind of enacting as a solution. He wants to try this out, and he's working it out in the articles themselves where he's laying down the problems. We're talking about particular people that have become involved in Critchley's life. And I think that your observation that they're mentor relationships too, I mean, Bernowski is not like a personal teacher to Critchley, but at the same time, a lot of people would claim that they were taught by, you know, people in books and whatnot. I don't see why TV couldn't be the same way. I don't see why we couldn't say that Dr. Bernowski kind of almost raised Critchley, especially if that's what he was growing up with on television. That sort of basic education that he has. But to talk about Frank Chioffi a little bit, Frank Chioffi was Simon Critchley's philosophy professor. And as a professor, he had a particular, he gets written about as a bit of an eccentric. And that seems, I think that seems to be the right word. Chioffi is, well, he's a Wittgensteinian, or that when Simon Critchley is talking about Chioffi, he's talking specifically about a kind of Wittgensteinianism in him, and he has fragments of things, like he has little slips of paper that he writes on and keeps in his pocket, and when he comes to class, he pulls them out kind of dramatically, apparently, and reads them out. And they're kind of meant to be deconstructive in a sense, maybe even deflationary. So we have a grand theory or something like that, and Chioffi will reach into his pocket and just read something. Maybe I don't know the contents of what were in his, you know, what was in his pocket, but I can imagine, I can easily imagine, say, because apparently Keofi didn't, he kind of had it out for Freud. I can imagine he pulls out a fragment of Freud, and out of context, just sounds like nonsense. You know,
he has actually has kind of a wonderful thing to say about Freud, but I think that the, you know, the little almost like motif that you're bringing up of Keofi, as Critchley talks about him, Professor Keofi, as Critchley talks about being in his classes and seeing him bringing out these little pieces of paper, and they're just like basically just like quotes and like statements. And I think it highlights a lot of what this episode is going to be about, what we're going to talk about, which is you've got, there's people in the world who want truth, and then there's people who believe in truths. And Keofi was obvious. Keofi, clearly from Critchley's writing, at least what we're getting from him, hated the idea of capital T truth, not in terms of like a logical designation, but in terms of like a grand theory or narrative, right? Like I've got, you know, once you have all the pieces, you'll put them together and you'll like know everything, right? I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with various philosophical or ideological systems that claim to have answers for everything in some way, right? And I think where Critchley takes us is basically Keofi's pulling out these little pieces of paper and basically saying, like, I'm going to shoot down your big ideas with little ones that are actually meaningful.
And right. Meaningful. And that was the other thing that I was going to suggest, too. He might have been pulling, you know, Freud out of context and kind of just laughing at him. But the other thing is he might be pulling fragments from another work or his own thoughts that he kind of just scribbled down in the middle of reading Freud and just thinking, God, you know, this is so stupid. And then he realized he has some way of bringing his students to realize how kind of to deflate Freud in a way.
You know, I want to take things down a little bit of an odd route, something I noticed. And by the way, for our listeners, because we're basically just discussing these two articles, we found them interesting. They're very light and accessible reading. You can just look up if you're interested. It's The Dangers of Certainty, A Lesson from Auschwitz, again, and There Is No Theory of Everything, both by Simon Critchley. If you just type them into Google, they're available for free on the New York Times website. They take 20 minutes to read. They're you know, very accessible and easy. But one thing that I think is really, to kind of dissect them a little bit, is really interesting about, you know, what we're talking about today in terms of Keofi, is how the beginning of the article, actually, for listeners, Critchley takes quite a bit of time to talk about Keofi, and particularly to talk about him as like an educator and his teaching style, and particularly talks about how like he wasn't a big writer. Like, he did publish at least one book, but even by his own admission, he wasn't a publishing philosopher. Like, he didn't write a bunch of stuff. He wasn't constantly coming up with theories. He wasn't, you know, he was a teacher. Like, that was his main thing, is he taught. And I think, interestingly, one, those are, like, for any of you who have taken philosophy courses, those are generally actually the kind of people you interact with in, like, an academic environment. You know, unless you're going to some crazy school and want to schedule time, you know, a month in advance with your like very famous modern philosopher person, right? Most people you're actually going to interact with at most universities are more teaching level, especially at smaller institutions. And Brandon and I both went to VIU, which is kind of like a mid to small university. But I think it's kind of interesting to point out like Kofi's almost like whole character is that like it makes sense that he didn't write, because he didn't really believe in grand theorizing. And there's so much more versatility and flexibility and growth available in lecturing, in teaching, right? Like there's all sorts of flexibility in actually being out in the world and chatting with people and having discussions and having debates and doing this whole kind of thing. You know, obviously Socrates and Plato both wrote about this fact that once you start writing something, you're making a system, it's hardened, it's coalesced, it's this thing. And as Bernowski talks about, it basically becomes every time it becomes some kind of dogma. And so in a fun kind of way, Kofi like not writing was almost like you could read into that being his kind of way of being like, I'm not going to like do that. Like, I'm not going to be part of the dogma. I'm going to like do like just be out here, just constantly doing it, revising, chatting. And like, it's here while I'm here. And when I'm gone, like it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Kofi doesn't seem like he has an edifice to build or like a castle to construct, you know. He's interested. He does address ideas, but his effort is kind of negative in that sense. I mean, I think about the episode, or not the episode, but like the anecdote of the bug in his office. He sees the bug kind of, you know, rocking on its back, and apparently it's dying. And Kofi has the realization, like, oh my god, you know, the problem of other minds really does. It matters, like. Other people suffer. He has this insight in a way. I don't know how you would take an anecdote like that, though, and go and construct a grand metaphysical scheme out of that, though. It just kind of seems like a particular experience you have, and then you realize, and maybe it impacts you, and then maybe you pass it on, but...
Well, you would be more familiar with this than I would, probably, because it's been a long time since I've read Wittgenstein. But as you said earlier, Kofi was a Wittgensteinian. And I think there's definitely a lot of that, especially in later Wittgenstein, where there's a real rejection of grand narratives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, especially since Wittgenstein was kind of, well, it seemed like his project was to clarify rather than, like, clarify by description or clarify by bringing people to the experiences that they're really having. Rather than, I mean, you can, if you go and you read the Philosophical Investigations, you can start piecing the language that he's using. You know, he's talking about like language games, and he's talking about pictures, and he's talking about, you know, he's using games in a particular way. But he's not like using they're kind of like tools that work. And when he needs a new tool, he goes to the store and gets another tool. You know, he's not building an immutable philosophical edifice. He is working with a purpose for clarifying language. Now, and it shows itself in lots of different ways. I mean, it shows itself in kind of putting up thought experiments, in saying something and then seeing, okay, well, like, what am I really saying when I say it out? You know, we have this realization sometimes when we say something out loud, and then we realize what it really means only after we really say it. So sometimes he will just play with language by doing that. He tests the intelligibility of things by saying it and saying, okay, does that even make sense to say? Does it make sense to say in this particular circumstance and whatnot? But again, it all kind of comes back to the experience of clarifying things, of solving problems, not by playing by the problem's terms, but by seeing if there are other terms that we can understand the problem by in order to dissolve the problem. And you might need new language for that. You might need a different circumstance for that. One of the things that Wittgenstein says is you can elect objects of comparison. So if you put two things next to each other and you see their relations, sometimes problems seem to go away. And when I think about that, I think about one of the anecdotes that I was told about G.E.M. Anscombe, who was one of the translators, the early translators of Wittgenstein. She struggled with a metaphysical position called phenomenalism. And essentially what phenomenalism is, so when you look at, say, a blue flower, phenomenalists would say the blue is in the flower. Now we know that's incorrect, because blue is a consequence of an eye seeing at a particular spectrum, right? It sees in a particular light band. So the phenomenon blue isn't in the flower. But she said, you know, okay, like I've read all the literature, I can understand it, but I don't really, like, I can't wrap my head around it. you know, I want to believe it, but I just can't put myself in understanding that. So what Wittgenstein did was elected an object for comparison and said, okay, you have your blue flower and the blue is in the flower. That's like touching a hot stove and saying the pain is in the coil, right? No, the pain is in your hand. It's just that what hurt was the stove when you touched it, right? And apparently for Anselm, this initiated a kind of gestalt shift. It changed her understanding. This was one of the ways that Wittgenstein clarified things, was by analogy.
Maybe this is a good point for us to enter in on Kofi's two like distinctions in terms of truth, which is a very similar project to Wittgenstein. Obviously, don't worry for our listeners, the text that we're doing today is nothing like trying to read Wittgenstein. But it's got a very similar, just very kind of simplified thrust, which is humanistic truths as descriptions versus scientific truths as like statements about the world, facts about the world around us, material truths. What is at play here is, this is Critchley, by the way, what is at play here is a classic distinction made by Max Weber, between explanation and clarification, between casual or casual sounding hypotheses and interpretation. Weber's idea is that natural phenomena require causal explanation of the kind given by physics, say, whereas social phenomena require elucidation, richer, more expressive descriptions. I think you and I have talked about this before on the show, and this is a classic distinction, and it's one that I've still, probably one of the more the philosophical problems that I actually actively think about most frequently, which is, you know, another way of thinking about it is theory and practice. It's a very similar kind of structure. Although this is a little bit different because this is two different ways to sort of describe or understand the world. But obviously, we have a scientific perspective that asks about causal explanations. So why is there a mountain, right? And we can give real hard truths explaining how that mountain came to be and what it's generally like for mountains to arise, like what are the various types of conditions, the different options, all that kind of stuff. And these things, these are like direct descriptions of how the world actually is, if we accept that there's like an external world and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, let's just take that off for granted. We're not going to do that right now. Those are direct descriptions of how the world actually is, right? But then there's also interpretations. And these are pretty humanistic and have to do directly with our experience and trying to elucidate what ours and others' experience is like. But there's always going to be a gap in terms of like actually, like, because I can't jump inside Brandon and literally be Brandon for, you know, the day or whatever it needs to be. And by be Brandon, I don't actually see, obviously that brings up a problem as brought up before. I don't mean me pretending to be Brandon in his body, literally being you. That's not a thing. So we're always left with this kind of explanatory gap in terms of how we can talk about human experiences. And we can't, basically, you can't talk about them directly. And more importantly, actually, to say it better, you can talk about them directly, but in a weird way, they stop being meaningful when you talk about them super directly, right? So, like, we take another example. Critchley is a similar one. If you came to me, Brandon, you were heartbroken. You know, Brandon's talking to me about the pain he's suffering, loss of his love, or whatever it is. This is deeply impactful for his own personal life. And I start rattling off how, oh, well, what's going on for you right now is that, you know, you're just having a certain releases in the brain of certain chemicals because you built this bond with someone that is actually like a bond that you're supposed to make because of evolution for biological reasons and blah, 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 blah. If we did that whole thing, that would be the wrong kind of approach for dealing with your issues, for dealing with, like, you know, someone's real personal life or interpersonal problems, issues, successes, whatever it might be.
Well, one of the
Like that is not helpful.
Yeah. Well, one of the points is that not only is it not helpful, I mean, in some instances it might be because people suffer depression or something and they need to get on some kind of medication. So it might sometimes be helpful. Oftentimes it's not. It misses the mark. And that is what we're talking about. But it's also just doesn't actually capture my experience, because when I, you know, I suffer like a bad breakup or something like that, my experience is not, oh no, my brain. It's, oh no, what am I going to do without them? You know, and to say that, okay, well, actually what's really going on here is there's some stuff going on in your brain, is it's not to be dishonest, but it is to not pay attention to what's actually going on in one's experience, right? Like, sometimes we do have experiences of quantifiability. You know, I go to the store and, uh-oh, I don't have enough money to pay for what I need. And so when someone says, what's wrong? I can say, I don't have this, you know, I don't have this amount. Okay, well, that's pretty intelligible. Someone says, I'm too tall to get on the roller coaster. Well, by how much? You know, a foot or something like that. Okay. But, you know, someone saying, I want to study philosophy, but I can't. That's a different question. You know, you couldn't ask them, okay, well, is it because your grades aren't good? That's quantifiable. But no, they just have this kind of vague worry about it. You know, I think a lot of the worries that people going into studying philosophy might have, that if you study philosophy, in a way, you do understand that experience, even if you can't describe it, or you feel like every description that you give of it is just one step behind being complete. You know, it's this feeling of completion that something like a quantity gives you a sense of. So if I don't have enough money to pay for my groceries or whatever, and I need $20, that's the answer. It's $20. But if I say I don't feel, you know, up to the task of doing philosophy and or like studying it or committing my life to studying it, you know, you could say, well, it's a really risky, and also I don't know if it's really my passion, or I don't know if I could really, like, how long would it really last? Is this just kind of like an infatuation? It's a phase, or like an infatuation. But we can go on and on and on and on and on understanding what is going on here. One of the things involved, to go back to it, it's that you're kind of always one step behind that completion that quantifiable problems always promise and presuppose.
Yeah, you know what, I thought that was like excellent how you brought that out, and it's that sense of completion. And as we talk like more about specifically the ideological sides of this discussion, you know, there's always been like a certain subset of people, I think everybody probably has this, where it's like you want to know, like you want the knowledge, you want the secret truth, and that's, you know, Kofi was sort of attacking grand systems, as Simon Critchley is going out there and saying there's no theory of everything. You know, theories of everything are initially rewarding because they provide a feeling of certainty.
Yeah, they provide that feeling of completion, like, I understand now.
I've got it. Like, I know it's all about free markets, right? And letting people be free and have free speech and say it's all about, you know, state control and you know, you know, workers owning of that means of production. It's all about, you know, whoever you pick, your Kim Jong-un, it doesn't matter, right? Like, pick your ideology. But like, they, what they give is certainty.